Book 10, Royal Progress. Fire Princess Katara had a secret. It wasn't the secret some of the more waggish opportunists in her father's court thought she had. That was errant nonsense. The idea that her unusually dusky skin tone could be traced back to some sort of shenanigans involving one of her post-war ancestors and the Water Tribe was an attractive one to a certain stripe of Fire Nation political animal, but it didn't hold up to scrutiny. Of course, her father having named her after a prominent figure in the post-war Southern Water Tribe did nothing to dispel that kind of rumor, but such was Katara's contrariety of spirit that she'd always been vaguely disappointed that there was no way she really could be descended from her namesake. She would rather have enjoyed that on a number of levels. In the event, though, it couldn't be so. If nothing else, the timing simply didn't work. She was darker than many of her relatives because of a quirk of her mother's genetic line, nothing more. That august lady's father, for instance, had been as brown as an old copper coin. No, Katara's secret was less salacious than that, albeit possibly not much less explosive politically. Since she was a little girl, Princess Katara had possessed an imaginary friend. This personage first appeared to her in the summer of 277 ASC, shortly after she'd celebrated her 6th birthday. As she sat at the dressing table in her bedroom and brushed her hair one day, someone else walked into view in the mirror on the back of the table, which afforded a fairly wide view of the room to anyone seated before it. At first, Katara assumed that this was her nanny, Mrs. Kwan, come to help her sort out her clothes and paid her little mind. Mrs. Kwan was always trying to help, and though she often accomplished little more than to get in the way, Katara knew she meant well and rarely had the heart to scold her for it. She would usually just let her get on with it. Only, when she finished with her hair and at last looked up, she saw that it wasn't Mrs. Kwan. It was somebody Katara had never seen before. A grown-up, but much younger and prettier than the princess's matronly nanny. Dressed in archaic clothes like the ones Katara had seen in the Fire Nation Museum, she was standing by the end of the bed, looking around the room with an enigmatic little smile on her face. This broadened slightly as she saw that Katara had at last noticed her. "Hello," she said. Her voice was unlike any Katara had heard before, a low, throaty purr with more than a hint of mischief. She stepped away from the bed, sauntering casually toward the dressing table. In spite of the fact that she was an obvious intruder, nothing about her felt threatening to Katara. There was mischief in her smile as well as her voice, but it was of a kind that invited the princess to take part in it, not threatening at all. For some reason, Katara almost felt she knew the woman, though she was certain she did not. Puzzled, the princess turned around, and there was no one there. Katara blinked in confusion, then turned back to the mirror. The mystery woman was still there, closer to her now. She turned to look again, but the room was still empty. "Well, okay," she thought, and turned to the mirror once again, to find that, in the mirror world anyway, the mysterious woman was standing right next to her now. "Hi," said Katara. "I tell you you're not going crazy," said the mystery woman with a wink, "but that wouldn't carry a lot of weight coming from someone who isn't really here. Is this your bedroom?" Katara hesitated for a moment, then decided that whatever was going on, it wasn't going to be any fun at all if she didn't play along. "Yes," she said. The mystery woman's amber eyes, bright and clear and very like Katara's own, sparkled merrily. "Do you like it?" she asked. Katara frowned. This would have been an odd line of questioning from anyone, but particularly from a strange woman in old-fashioned clothes who only seemed to exist in her dressing mirror. "Yes," she repeated. It's a good room. It has the best view of the gardens. The mysterious woman's smile broadened. I'm so glad, she said. I always thought that was the best thing about it, too. This used to be my room, when I was a little girl myself, she explained. What's your name?
I'm Katara, the princess said.
Then, drawing herself up a little self-consciously, she corrected herself and said formally, Fire Princess Katara. The mystery woman looked slightly taken aback by that for a moment, then laughed as if it were the most delightful surprise. I'll bet that choice of name put the cat among the pigeon mice when it was announced, she said cheerfully. Oh, wait until I tell she who must be obeyed that she's Katara the Elder now. Katara, the younger, looked even more confused. She glanced reflexively at where her visitor should be again, saw nothing once more, and then looked back to her reflection that wasn't a reflection and said, She who what? Who are you? And how did you get in my mirror? Her eyes going wide with a sudden thought, the princess added hopefully, Are you a ghost? The mystery woman laughed again. There have been times when I've wondered about that myself, she said. But no, I'm not. I am speaking to you from the spirit world right now, though. Do you know about the spirit world? Katara nodded. Good. The woman in the mirror made the firebender salute to her and bowed. It's a pleasure to meet you, Princess Katara. My name is Azula. I'm your... She paused, thinking. Great, great, great aunt, I think. I might be off a great. Smiling again, she went on, You've probably never heard of me. Katara stared at her with a combination of bafflement, skepticism, and wonder. How can you not be a ghost if you're from that long ago? I eat right and get plenty of exercise, said Azula blithely. Katara rolled her eyes. She knew a grown-up evasion when she heard one, and dropped it for the moment, asking instead, Why are you here? Azula looked like she might be considering another smart answer. She crossed behind Katara's chair, trailing her fingertips idly along the top of its back, and then said, I'm curious. I've been away from home for a long time. If I were ever to come back, it'd be good to have a friend. She smiled her playful smile again. Would you like to be friends, Katara? Sure, said Katara at once. Excellent, said Azula. Only right now I have to go to breakfast, Katara added, glancing at her bedside clock. And then there are my lessons. And it's Sinti C, she added, making a face. Double math. Will you be here tonight? I think I can arrange that, said Azula airily. Bring your homework. I was always pretty good at math. Maybe I can help you. Right now, though, you'd better get a move on. Wouldn't want to keep the Fire Lord waiting. Have you found the double secret ninja back way to the dining room yet? Katara looked intrigued. No, she said. What's that? Azula's smile became mischievous again as she leaned down next to her young descendant's shoulder. Well, she said, first you go to the south hallway. Thursday, July 11th, 2396. James Bigglesworth Aerodrome, Valhalla, Asgard. Even amid the wildly assorted jumble of aerospacecraft to be found on the apron at Biggles Field on any given Thursday morning, the starship Phoenix Queen stood out. Her sleek lines and brilliant scarlet livery set her apart on virtually any apron. But here, where the parked craft could and generally did range back to the earliest days of aviation, on several worlds, she was like a woman in a bathing suit amid a crowd of men in overalls. Her captain always parked her here, though,
and not at the main spaceport outside the Golden City, because it was Valhalla she was always coming to visit anyway. As one of the few and proud mortal veterans of the Ragnarok, Azula possessed the vanishingly rare privilege of returning to the Hall of Heroes whenever she liked, in order to visit her friends and relations who dwelt there in celestial glory. It was a privilege she exercised, as a general rule, 3 or 4 times a year. At a little past noon, the Phoenix Queen's first mate woke from a heavy sleep occasioned by the gala evening before, spent a little quality time with the auto spa, and then, refreshed, went to see what, if anything, was doing. The thing that most impressed Ty Lee about the present state of affairs was how much bigger the Phoenix Queen felt with only herself and Azula aboard. It wasn't as though the vessel had been cramped before. There had been ample space for the crew of 6, not counting herself, the ship had had when Ty Lee first joined up. But with the others gone, the Queen felt positively vast. Vast and quiet, particularly on the ground, without the constant subliminal hum of the drive systems. The sensation put her in a thoughtful, vaguely wistful frame of mind as she went forward and found Azula on the flight deck. The ship's captain sat in her accustomed seat, port side forward, with her booted feet up on a stanchion near the console, looking at something in a holographic display window hovering nearby. "Morning," said Ty Lee as she entered the compartment. "Good morning, Ty Lee," said Azula pleasantly, without looking up. "When did you get back?" Ty Lee wondered. "Only a few minutes ago," Azula said. Ty Lee sat down at the navigator station on the starboard side of the compartment, swiveled the seat so it faced Azula's, and asked, "What are you reading?" "Oh, just the mail," Azula replied. She took her boots off the stanchion and turned to face Ty Lee, placing them instead on the arm of the vacant co-pilot's seat, then reached back and drew the hollow window around so that it was in her field of view again. "Boone wrote this morning. Marta had the baby yesterday. A boy, apparently. They've named him Cassidy, poor thing," she added dryly. Ty Lee wrinkled her nose. "Cassidy Boone," she said. "That sounds like an advertising agency." Azula shrugged eloquently. "Just be glad they didn't name him after the attending physicians," she said. "Imagine trying to get through grammar school with a name like Arcade Mitchell Boone y Velasquez." "There's that," Ty Lee agreed. "Any other news?" Azula traced the mail window's holographic scroll bar with a fingertip, eyes scanning the message. "Nothing much. I expect he's a bit preoccupied. Not enough spare mental capacity to provide his usual exhaustive sit rep," she said wryly. Ty Lee chuckled. "I suppose so." Then, with a mischievous grin, she added, "You missed a great party last night." "Was there cactus juice?" Azula inquired. "Yes, there was." Azula raised an eyebrow. "And is there video?" "Yes, there is." "Excellent." "Where did you go instead?" Ty Lee wondered. "Mother and I visited the spirit world. It's much easier to reach from here than back in Midgard, for whatever reason. At any rate," she went on with a little smile, "I believe I've made a new friend, one I shall have to look in on whenever we're in the neighborhood." Sintc, Liu UA 11, 277 ASC, Thursday, June 11th, Standard Year 2396. Royal Palace, Caldera City, Fire Nation, Dicho. Katara was delighted to discover that her ancestor's secret route shaved a good 3 minutes off the time it took her to reach the dining room from her bedroom. She arrived in plenty of time for breakfast, and had the pleasure of seeing the 2 guards by the entrance give each other utterly confounded looks as she appeared in the room without having passed them. For as long as Katara could remember, which was admittedly not that long, her father had insisted that his family have breakfast together whenever it was practical to do so, which was virtually always, unless unscheduled matters of state intruded. It was one of her favorite times of the day, when she got to see her father before he put his stern face on and became the Fire Lord, and her mother before she put her stern face on and became Chief Minister Haru. After 9 a.m., they belonged to the nation, but before then, they were just her parents. They were most of the way through the meal when Katara suddenly asked, "Is my room haunted?"
Not that I know of,"
Fire Lord Kinzon replied after a moment's reflection.
"Why do you ask?"
"Just wondering," said the princess with unconvincing offhandedness. For the next few years, Azula became something of a fixture in young Katara's life. She wasn't always around. Being a very busy princess, Katara didn't always have time for her. And besides, she explained, she had a lot of things to do herself. But three or four times a year, there would be a week or two at a time when she would appear nightly in Katara's dressing mirror, and they would catch up on all the things that had gone on since last they had seen one another. Azula was right when she speculated at their first meeting that Katara had probably never heard of her, but that was an oversight the young princess corrected at the earliest opportunity. Her parents had been curiously reluctant to speak of the matter, but Uncle Kazan, her father's brother, had told her the basic facts. How Princess Azula had been old Fire Lord Zuko's sister, their dread father's favorite during the closing days of the Hundred-Year War. He glanced over the details. Katara was, after all, just a child, albeit a clever and perceptive one. But she gathered that Azula had been ill somehow and had disappeared after the war. The rest of it she put together piece by piece over the years, as her access to historical documents and her understanding of their use and context expanded. Whenever she put questions about her latest findings to Azula during their conversations, the elder was always ready to answer them, her manner candid and direct. She hid nothing, only occasionally deferring various details of the story until such time as Katara would be old enough to process them fully. And she always said so when she was doing that. As Katara grew older, and her life grew ever more complex and challenging, the spirit of her ancestor was one of the lodestars of her life, a comforting, supportive, non-judgmental presence in whom she could confide pretty much anything. She shared all her troubles and heartaches, of which, the princess being a passionate soul, there were many. Venting all the pressures of the royal life, the expectations, the essential loneliness of being an only child in such a rarefied position in life. Azula, in turn, told wondrous stories of her adventures, both around Dicho and all over the big universe beyond. As Katara became more and more sophisticated, these tales took on greater subtlety of nuance, slowly evolving from simple stories of bold adventure into explorations of more mature and difficult themes. Azula didn't always come out of these in the best light, but they were what they were, and one thing she never did once Katara was old enough to understand them was whitewash her own mistakes. In Katara's 12th year, she left home to join her cousin Shinzen, who was several years her elder, at exclusive Piandao Academy, far from home in the eastern island town of Shujing. It wasn't the farthest she'd ever been from home by a long shot. She had accompanied her parents on state visits to all the world's capitals, but she had never spent more than a few days away from Caldera, and never away from them, before. She'd also never had a full-time roommate. As an only child, she hadn't had any reason to share her bedroom with anyone other than the ghost, which Azula still insisted she wasn't, but mathematically, Katara couldn't see how she could possibly be anything but. In her dressing mirror. Tutor room was the rule at Piandao Academy, though. And there were no exceptions, not even for the Crown Princess of the Fire Nation herself. apart from a couple of very discreet security personnel. So discreet, in fact, that Katara never actually saw them. Nothing was to be arranged differently for her in any way. Xintiu, Jiuyue 21, 282 ASC. Friday, September 21st, Standard Year 2401. Piandao Academy, Shujing, Fire Nation. Katara had been at the academy for nearly 3 weeks when she first saw Azula there. One Friday evening, she was alone in her room in the north wing of Piandao House, doing her homework, when she caught movement out of the corner of her eye, turned in her chair, and saw her ancestor leaning casually against the frame of her dressing mirror as though it were a door jamb. "Aunt Azula," she cried, jumping up and running to the mirror. "Hello, Katara," said Azula warmly. She raised a hand as if placing it against the inside of a window, and Katara matched it on the outside of the glass, which was as close as they could get to touching. "What a pleasant little room," she added, looking around. "A bit smaller than our old place, but cozy." "I was afraid I'd have to wait until winter break to see you again," Katara said. "I didn't know if you'd be able to find me here." Azula smiled. "I can find you wherever you are," she said, then paused, looking thoughtful. You know, that sounded much less creepy in my head." Katara laughed. "It's okay," she said. Then, pulling her chair over to the mirror, she sat down and asked, "So, what's new on your end?" "Precious little, I'm afraid," said Azula. She seated herself in an elaborately carved Azulon chair. She'd say this for her grandfather, the old bastard had good taste in furniture. Crossing her legs elegantly at the knee, and went on, "The queen is in for a refit, and until that's finished, I've nothing to do but push my sister-in-law's buttons and work on my memoirs." Katara giggled. "You're mean," she said. "On occasion," Azula allowed. Then, smiling, she said, "What about you? Settling in all right? I envy you, you know. I didn't get to go to an actual school until after Karafuto, and by then I was nearly too old to enjoy it properly." She nodded toward the bunk beds by the far wall. "I see you have a roommate?" Katara nodded. "Everybody here does." "What's she like?" "Well, I don't really know her very well yet," said Katara. "She's really quiet, kind of shy. She seems nice, though. Her name's Jing. She's from the Earth Kingdom." "Oh-ho," said Azula, eyebrows rising. "Charming place, the Earth Kingdom. I used to be queen of there once." "Oh, you did not either," said Katara with cheerful scorn. "I read that book." "I see historical revisionism is alive and well in the Chun Tai era," said Azula, mock annoyed. Then she dropped the pose with an indulgent eye roll and went on, "Well, hopefully she'll come out of her shell as she gets to know you better." Xinti-san, Yuyue 10, 290 ASC. Wednesday, June 10th, Standard Year 2409. Piandao Academy. "Stop fidgeting, Katara, or I'll never be able to get this right." "I'm not fidgeting," Katara objected. "You're ow! Pulling my hair." "I'm combing your hair," Jing corrected her. "Because if I don't, you'll look like you've been dragged to the rehearsal behind a runaway ostrich horse. I told you not to sleep on it wet, but no." Katara sighed. "I don't know why I let you talk to me that way," she grumped. "I'm a princess. I shouldn't have to stand for it." Unconcerned, Jing carried on combing her roommate's long black hair. "A, because you love me." Not in that way. they added, simultaneously parenthetical. And B, because you know I'm right. Katara sighed again, deeper this time, and said with heavy mock resignation, "Fine, carry on." "Thank you," said Jing with elaborate courtesy. Finishing the repair job, she put the comb aside, wedged a few hairpins in the corner of her mouth to free her hands, and started arranging Katara's hair in the elaborately formal style she'd chosen to wear it in for their graduation ceremony. Watching the operation in the mirror, Katara failed to stop a smile from breaking through her put-on, put-upon scowl. All got up in their graduation robes, she and her roommate looked practically like adults. Katara was a head taller than Jing, but slimmer, with that lean and vaguely raptorial look many of her ancestors had sported. At 17, she looked every inch her father's daughter, although, as cousin Shinzen had once quipped, she made the Kinzon nose look a lot better than the old man did himself. Jing, by contrast, was shorter, but looked stronger. Not squat or stocky, but compact and powerfully built, with a round face and quick, bright eyes that gave her a near-constant air of merriment. She'd had no difficulties with her own hair, because she had very much less of it than her roommate. She kept it closely, almost ruthlessly bobbed, and at the moment most of it was underneath the green and gold pillbox hat she wore as an emblem of her birthplace. Jing was Katara's opposite in many ways. Phlegmatic, where Katara was sanguine, with a full measure of the sturdy practicality so stereotypical of her native land. She was a commoner, albeit a wealthy one, born to a merchant family in the upper ring of Ba Sing Se, and she professed little awe at the trappings of nobility. Her only response to Katara's occasional fits of aristocratic impatience was to roll her eyes a little and patiently wait her out. It never took long, since the princess's flashes of temper would always burn out as quickly as they flared up. They were a fixed point, these two, the semi-official class couple of Form 7, almost always together, often bickering happily, but always mutually supportive underneath the cosmetic incompatibility. Whether by chance or the subtle design of Headmaster Chang Dao, who was renowned for his ability to arrange such meetings of hearts and minds in his rooming assignments. Their personalities meshed in useful and complementary ways, making them greater together than the sum of their individualities. Now, as she did her best to sit still and let Jing work, Katara smiled as a third figure joined them in the mirror. "Well, well, well," said Azula, smiling. "Look at you two, all dressed up." "Our graduation rehearsal is in half an hour," Katara explained. "Thank you, I'm aware of that," Jing mumbled around the hairpins she hadn't placed yet. Then, glancing past Katara at the princess's smiling reflection, she said, "Ah, you're not talking to me." With a little grin, she raised a hand and a sardonic wave at the mirror, and said in a slightly raised voice, "Hello, Katara's imaginary dead aunt." "I can understand her assuming that I'm imaginary," said Azula, for nothing like the first time, "but it really annoys me that she thinks I'm also dead." "We could prove that you're not either," said Katara. "Graduation is this Saturday. I want you to come." Azula blinked at her in surprise. "Are you serious?" she asked. "Of course I'm serious," Katara replied. "It's tempting," Azula allowed, "but I doubt I'd be terribly welcome." "I can make you welcome," said Katara, her jaw jutting fiercely. "I'm the damn crown princess." "Oh, this should be good," Jing murmured. "Hush!" Katara snapped. "Will you do it? I want you there. I want to meet you in person at last. You've always told me you're not a ghost. Well, it's time for you to prove it." Azula regarded her several greats niece for a long moment, her face set in a little frown of thought. And for a second Katara wondered if she might just have pushed her mercurial ancestor a little too hard. But then the elder princess grinned, all her teeth showing, and replied, "You're on, kiddo. Saturday, you say? Tricky, but doable. What time should I get there?" Now it was Katara's turn to blink in surprise. When seized by the impulse to issue the challenge, she hadn't actually considered the possibility that it might work. 10 o'clock? She said, picking a time before the midday ceremony more or less at random. "Done," said Azula at once. "It won't be a problem if I bring a friend, I hope?"
No. I'll take care of it," said Katara haltingly.
"Good. Best to use my big universe name, I should think. I doubt your parents are prepared to cope with anything else, much less the rest of the world. Sarah Inazuma plus one for 10 o'clock Saturday. Well, I'd best get a move on. I'll see you then." And with that, she was gone. "So?" Jing wondered, completing her job and stepping back to regard it. "Is she coming?"
"Uh-huh."
Jing shook her head with an indulgent smile. "Only you would call your own imaginary friend's bluff," she said.
"Yeah, keep laughing. You'll see," Katara said, and then thought, "I hope."
Sinti Liu, Liu Yue 13, Saturday, June 13th. At 10 minutes past 10 that morning, Jing was exercising all her considerable powers of forbearance and not pointing out to Katara that no one had appeared. Lying on her bed and gazing bleakly at the ceiling, the girl looked legitimately upset, somewhat calling into question Jing's long-standing assumption that the imaginary friend thing was kind of a game the princess played with herself and her roommate. She seemed genuinely to believe that her long-lost great-great-great-aunt, who had been missing since the year 102 for Bosco's sake, had promised to show up for their graduation. She was just considering how she might broach the subject without seeming to be gloating, when, somewhat to her surprise, there came a knock at the door. Katara was up and halfway to the door before Jing could even draw breath. Once there, she hesitated for just a second, her hand reaching for the knob, as though she were half afraid to open it and see who was calling. Whoever it was knocked again, a little more briskly this time. Katara took a deep breath, seemed to steady herself, and then opened the door. There were two people standing there, both women who seemed to be in their early 20s. One, standing to the right of and a little behind the one who knocked, was a cheerful-looking girl with dark brown hair drawn back in a long braid, dressed in a pale pink sundress and low red shoes. At the sight of Katara, she grinned and saluted, army style, a gesture that was entirely at odds with her breezily casual appearance. The other, standing dead center in the doorway, was a bit taller and leaner, with her long black hair worn down and loose, and a slightly sardonic little smile on her sharply beautiful face. Her crisp red silk shirt and snug-fitting black trousers were rather less casual than her companion's sundress. The trousers in particular, decked with a narrow red stripe down the outseams, almost looked like they came from some sort of uniform, an appearance heightened by the tall black motorcycling boots they were tucked into. "Sorry we're late," this individual said, smiling a little more broadly. "You wouldn't believe the paperwork at the Crescent Island Veil Nexus. Honestly, it's like the fire sages think they own the place." Katara stared blankly at her for a moment, sheer astonishment wiping away anything else that might have been on her face.
"You came," she murmured.
"Of course I came," the woman in black and red replied. "I told you I would."
Katara blinked, then smiled a beaming smile and threw her arms around her visitor.
"Aunt Azula," she cried, "you actually came."
"You are messing with me," said Jing slowly.
"I wish you wouldn't sound quite so surprised about that, Katara dear," said Azula with mock reproach as she returned the embrace.
"You make it sound as if I've some long-established habit of letting you down." Katara blushed.
"No, I wasn't sure. Oh, never mind. Come in, please."
She backed up a bit and gestured the two into the room.
Right. This is my roommate, Jing."
Azula made the firebender salute to her descendant's bemused roommate, then extended an elegantly manicured hand.
"Hello. We meet at last. At the moment, my tourist visa says I'm Sarah Inazuma from Karafuto, and far be it from me to argue with the Customs and Immigration Bureau," she added with a conspiratorial wink.
Then, noting that Jing hadn't made any effort to shake her hand, she added,
"Don't worry, I don't bite."
"Not uninvited, anyway," the woman in the pink dress quipped with a wink. Azula gave her a glance and a sardonic smile.
"Behave yourself, we're guests here," she said,
then turned back to Jing and said, "You'll have to excuse Tai Li, I'm afraid she's quite incorrigible. Agni knows I've tried." Jing hesitantly took the offered hand, still looking vaguely stunned.
Hi?
"I'm delighted to meet you," said Azula, giving her hand a squeeze and releasing it. "Katara's told me so much about you." Then, turning to the younger princess again, she went on, "So, how long do we have before you two need to start getting ready?"
"Not long," said Jing, recovering her practical aplomb quickly with a task at hand.
"The ceremony's at 11. We need to be ready to march by 4:45. Azula glanced at the clock on Katara's desk and nodded.
"Not a moment to be lost, then," she agreed. "We'll go and hobnob with the visiting dignitaries, shall we? And we'll see you after the show."
And with that, and a further hug, they were gone, leaving the two teenagers to contemplate the events of the last few minutes.
"I..." said Jing, and then stopped, unable to trust herself with any further words.
Katara stood looking at the closed door for a moment, then turned a little grin to her roommate.
"I told you," she said, and then went to her wardrobe.
It took a few minutes, once the graduation ceremony got underway, for Azula to realize quite what was striking her as odd about it. It wasn't the ceremony itself. That was fairly standard as these things went. Rather, it dawned on her partway through Headmaster Chang Dao's speech that a fair number of those attending weren't human. The reason it took this patently obvious fact so long to register was that this wasn't in any way unusual in her everyday life. Sarah Inazuma's world was that of the cosmopolitan 25th century spacer, constantly brushing elbows, or equivalent upper extremity articulation points, with members of 1,000 species in the course of regular business, from the Quarian fueling techs at Scandia 1 to that cheerful Rigelian weapons merchant who was the only reliable source for the obsolescent missiles the Phoenix Queen's launchers required. Here in Dicho, though, that kind of thing had been completely unknown when she was a girl. And though she had heard from Katara about the opening of the spirit world, which had happened years before the younger princess was born, during the elder's long sojourn in hibernation, she hadn't consciously considered what it meant until now. There weren't a lot of spirits here, but there were enough to stand out now that she had noticed them, particularly the one among the faculty up on the stage, who appeared to be a gaily colored moth about the size of a person, hovering with lazy wing beats rather than standing. Beyond the faintly surprising presence of the spirits in attendance,
The guest speakers represented Azula's first opportunity to get a look at certain of the important personages of this era. One of them, naturally, was Fire Lord Kinzon, invited to speak at his daughter and heir's graduation. As with Katara, Azula thought she could detect certain perennial traits of the family in him, but others had evidently entered the bloodline after her time. She couldn't remember her father or grandfather having had that impressive beak of a nose, for instance, and certainly her brother didn't have anything like it. The other was Aang's successor, Avatar Korra. Azula had heard many stories and seen several pictures of this individual. Katara the Elder and Zuko were both wont to get a bit sentimental about her from time to time, but she had a certain spark in person that didn't really come across in photographs. She bore no particular resemblance to Aang, though, in person or manner. Azula chalked that up as evidence that the whole "they're all really the same person" thing was just as much bunk as she'd always assumed it was. As for the two women who attended as Princess Katara's guests, their presence provoked no particular stir among the others in attendance. Those few who gave the matter any thought assumed that the black-haired one, with her faint resemblance to the princess and her obvious firebender's eyes, was an obscure relative of whom they'd never heard, possibly from the quiet and retiring Hira'a branch of the royal family. And as for the one in the pink dress, she was plainly some kind of bodyguard, despite her cheerfully casual appearance. Azula and Ty Lee hung back after the ceremony was over, waiting at a discreet distance while Katara's parents spoke with her. Even from here, the affection both the Fire Lord and his chief minister had for their daughter was obvious, and Azula found herself unexpectedly touched by it. She turned to see Ty Lee's reaction, and saw, not altogether to her surprise, that her friend was actually tearing up a little bit at the sight. "Sentimentalist," she said fondly. "Uh-huh," Ty Lee agreed with a sniffling smile. Kinzon and Haru didn't stay long, both because they had much to do and because they didn't want their royal gravity to encumber the occasion. After a few private remarks to several of the faculty, including the Moth Spirit, and a parting pair of hugs for Katara, they took their leave in as unostentatious a manner as was probably possible for VIPs of their caliber. As he was boarding the royal limousine for the short drive to the airport, the Fire Lord glanced over the gathered students, parents, and others, at last seeming to notice his daughter's guests. He paused for a moment, his eyes on Azula, but then got the rest of the way into the car and was whisked away without comment. "Think he recognized you?" Ty Lee wondered. "Probably not," Azula replied. "If he had, one tends to doubt he would have just left." She smiled slightly. "More likely, he's still trying to think where he's seen me before." "There you are," Katara's voice called to them, and they looked up to see the princess and her roommate threading their way through the crowd toward them. "Do you want to meet Korra? She and Master Shespa have to leave. Some kind of problem with the Great Library." "I think it's probably best if we leave that introduction for another time, actually," said Azula. "I don't believe the old theory that she's literally the rebirth of Aang. For one thing, I just saw him the other day, and he didn't look like that. But all the same, she stands a better than average chance of recognizing me," she added with a wry smile. "I'm not exactly hiding, but my presence here would take more explaining than I really feel like doing today." Katara gave a disappointed frown. "Aw, okay. Let me just go say goodbye, then." Korra and the other person named, a woman in air nomad robes, departed soon after, on the back of a sky bison, which gave Azula a surprisingly pleasant little twinge of nostalgia. With them gone, she and Ty Lee circulated for a while, chatting with various students' parents and members of the faculty. The Moth Spirit turned out to be a very pleasant but slightly distracted science teacher, evidently concerned mainly with meteorology and environmental studies. After a few moments, she excused herself and flittered off in roughly the direction in which the bison had gone.
Whatever's going on has all the scholar spirits in an uproar, Katara mused as she and Jing rejoined them. Professor Mosura's all aflutter, Jing agreed. As it were. Somebody probably outraged Mr. Owl again, said Katara. Maybe he finally found out there aren't really tiny actors inside television sets, Jing speculated. Ah, well, Korra will take care of it, Katara said. What did you guys think of the ceremony? It was lovely, said Ty Lee with a grin. Your father's quite a speaker. I wonder where he got that from, she added, nudging Azula with an elbow. It was nowhere in evidence in your day. Azula chuckled. No, indeed, she said. Katara giggled. He has his moments, she allowed. So what are your plans now? Ty Lee wondered. I never graduated from any place. Well, except prison. So I'm not sure what happens next. Ignoring the deeply dubious look Jing was giving her ancestor's companion in response to the prison remark, Katara replied, That's kind of not decided yet. I want to go to college, but Dad wants me to go home and start doing the princess thing full time. He says if I want a degree, I can just make Caldera University give me one, which is kind of not the point. I mean, that's the whole reason I came here, she added, gesturing around. I could have just gone to the Royal Fire Academy, but everyone would have assumed that I'd have been an honors graduate from there, no matter what. A diploma from this place means I actually know things. Said Azula with a thoughtful nod. Then she smiled and said, Well, keep working on him. You'll wear him down. Katara grinned. That's my plan. In the meantime, Mother insists that I at least get the summer off before I have to start showing up for state functions and whatnot. I don't really have a plan, but... Why don't you come to Ba Sing Se with me? Jing asked. You can finally meet my family. Katara gave her a skeptical look. Your family that I've never seen at Parents' Day or the start or end of any term? The ones who didn't even come to graduation? That family? They're busy people, Jing insisted. When you meet them, you'll understand. Come on, it'll be fun. You get us to Republic City with your fancy-pants Navy connections, and then we'll take the train to Ba Sing Se. You two should come along, too, she added to Azula and Ty Lee, if you can spare a few days. Ty Lee looked thoughtfully to Azula. You've never seen Republic City, she said. It's pretty good. Or it was when I was there last. Admittedly, that was a while ago. That sounds like a fine idea, Azula agreed. I haven't taken a good old-fashioned road trip in a long time. Tintiyi, Liu Yue 15, Monday, June 15th, Earth Kingdom. The former coastal colonies had changed dramatically, and the train was much more modern than Azula remembered, but the scrubby desert outside Ba Sing Se was just the same. Watching it slide by out the window of the number 2 sleeper car of the Western Empire Express, Azula wondered how different the Earth Kingdom's vast capital city itself would be. She hadn't been there in nearly 200 years, since departing in triumph to return to the Fire Nation and prepare for the endgame of the Hundred-Year War. It hadn't changed appreciably for many more years than that before then. But then, the world hadn't changed very much in all the many centuries Ba Sing Se had stood before she got to it. Uh-oh. You've got your big thoughts face on, Ty Lee observed, slipping into the seat next to her. Azula glanced at her, then half smiled and turned back to the view. Just reflecting on how much this world has changed since I was last in it. Zuzu wasn't exaggerating after all when he said he and Aang and their friends basically reinvented the place once Father was dealt with. She shook her head. Maybe it's just as well I missed that. I probably wouldn't have been able to handle it happening all around me, particularly when I hadn't been torn down and rebuilt myself.
Ty Lee leaned a little closer and took her hand.
"You'd have found a way," she said. "You were always a survivor, even then."
Azula regarded their linked hands for a moment, then raised them and kissed the back of Ty Lee's before telling her wryly,
"You are a terrible judge of character."
Ty Lee would have replied, but just at that moment she heard a sound so sharply out of context where they were now that it took her a moment to place it. She glanced at Azula and saw that she'd heard it too. Frowning, Azula turned and looked out the window again. For a moment there was nothing more to see out there than before. And then, pulling up even with the number two car from behind, came another vehicle.
"Well, that's not supposed to be here," Azula remarked, for the vehicle pacing the train, a dark-clad figure astride it, was a repulsor lift swoop. As she regarded him with a quizzical frown, the man riding the swoop looked up and seemed to notice her, then hunched lower over his handlebars and opened the throttle, accelerating past the car. A moment later, another one followed him by.
Ty Lee darted across the compartment and into the aisle running along the right-hand side of the car. From those windows, she could see two more swoop-mounted outriders catching the train on that side.
"They're over here, too," she cried. Rising from her seat, Azula started forward for the door leading to the number one car. But before she reached it, the train derailed. She and Ty Lee were ready for that, not because they had been expecting it, but because they were more or less always prepared for such things to happen by this point in their lives. The car they were in plunged off the tracks to the left, bumping and banging over the rocky scrubland, its upper structure swaying violently. Her face set in a scowl of concentration, Azula blasted away one of the skylights above the sitting room area of their first-class compartment, then sprang upward, caught hold of the coaming, and levered herself up onto the roof. Ty Lee was right behind her, using one of the seats as a springboard and bounding clean out without having to use her hands at all, except for balance. Their situation was not manifestly better up here. The sleeper car was still thundering across the hardpan, jouncing and shuddering. A mere moment after they arrived on the roof, the car struck a boulder and tipped onto its side, crashing down with an almighty smashing of glass and a shriek of metal on rock. By this point, though, it had bled off enough of its speed that the two women were able to leap clear and roll to a halt in the dust without breaking themselves to pieces. Behind them, all but the locomotive and the first sleeper car of the Western Empire Express slid noisily to a stop in a jumbled mess, some cars fallen onto their sides, others half run up onto the ones ahead of them, and jutting up at crazy angles. For a moment, Azula and Ty Lee lay where they'd come to rest, sprawled on the dusty ground. Then, slowly, they stirred and pulled themselves together, climbing painfully to their feet. Without exchanging a word, they dusted themselves off and checked each other for serious injuries, and discovered that, though bruised and scuffed, their clothing dirty and torn, they were largely unharmed. They turned and looked up the line to see what had become of the head of the express. This had come to rest a half mile or so farther along. The locomotive was derailed as well, lying over on its right side next to the tracks with a fire burning in its engine compartment. But number one sleeper car was miraculously still upright, rolling gently to a stop some distance beyond the wrecked engine. The swoop outriders were circling it, reminding Azula of vultures, until one of them noticed the two survivors from number two sleeper and gestured violently to another. With a nod, the second peeled away from the formation and started making straight for them. Ty Lee looked at Azula. "Do you want this one?" she asked.
Azula smiled and made a gracious gesture.
"No, by all means, be my guest."
Ty Lee grinned.
"You're too good to me," she said.
Then, turning to face the oncoming swoop, she pulled off her ruined sundress, this one had been white, over her head and tossed it away.
Beneath it, she wore a snug-fitting dark green garment, sleeveless and legless, a bit like a warm-water wetsuit. Azula never tired of seeing this bit of kit in action, and she wondered what the Swoop Rider was making of it as the sleeves and leggings of Ty Lee's Experts of Justice smart suit, the very latest thing from the Stark Industries tactical toy shop, extruded themselves down her limbs and mated to her half-gloves and shoes, leaving her covered from neck to toe in fireproof, bullet-resistant hyper-silk. He didn't have long to consider it, however, because within a second or so he was on top of her. She saw his teeth flicker in a vicious smile below his goggles as he bore down on her, intending to run her down with his Swoop's razor-sharp steering vanes. He had just enough time for that expression to be replaced with a look of blank astonishment as, with split-second timing, she leaped over those vanes, springing straight up between the handlebars so that the micro-mesh-reinforced cap of one of her tack suit's knees rammed square into the middle of his face. His goggles shattering, he pitched backward out of the saddle, tumbled like a rag doll across the dusty ground, and fetched up at Azula's feet. Ty Lee balanced for a moment on the pommel of the Swoop's saddle, arms outstretched, as if to demonstrate the perfection of her form for the judges. Then she whirled and dropped into the seat, seizing control of the vehicle before it could crash under her. Its repulsors howled as it banked steeply to starboard, footpeg throwing up a crescent of dust. She righted it, braked, and brought it around to where Azula stood looking thoughtfully down at its former owner. "He seems to be wearing some sort of uniform," Azula observed, disdainfully towing over the unconscious form so that he lay on his back. His clothes did indeed seem like a uniform, mostly black leather with piping of bright sky blue, and on his breast something glinted. Frowning, she crouched and pulled it off his jacket, then straightened and held it up to the sunlight, regarding it closely. It was a metal badge about the size of a policeman's shield, silver-backed and richly enameled in the same azure color, and its shape was curiously familiar, like an even more stylized version of the Fire Nation's triple flame crest. "What do you make of this?" Azula asked, but Ty Lee wasn't listening. Looking up from the badge, Azula saw that she was staring up the rail line, her face blank with astonishment. She turned to see what was so surprising over there, and then had to agree that it was, in fact, pretty astonishing. "Where did that come from?" she wondered aloud, sounding, if anything, faintly annoyed. From somewhere, while they were occupied with the outrider, another locomotive had arrived. It wasn't a Western Line rescue tender, or anything of that sort, though. In fact, Azula would have bet that it belonged to no proper railroad company. Slab-sided and heavily armored, without any visible windows, it looked more like some kind of primitive siege engine than a piece of railway rolling stock. As they watched, it backed up to the number one car, and, since that car's coupling had been sheared away, seized hold of it with a sort of massive articulated metal claw, evidently provided specifically for the purpose. Then, its prize securely gripped, it started pulling away, accelerating smartly with only the one carriage to pull. As it sped off, the other three outriders took up formation around it. "You don't see that every day," Ty Lee observed. "No," Azula agreed, but before she could comment further, a bolt of fire shot past above her head. This didn't cause her to duck and curse, as any normal person would have, but she did turn to see where it had come from. Some distance behind them, survivors had begun to pull themselves from the wreckage of the Western Empire Express. A few were sitting on the ground or leaning against rocks and bits of the wreck, clearly injured or in shock, but others, men and women in curiously similar dark suits, were running toward them, most of them shouting either at Azula and Ty Lee or into radios. The woman in the lead had clearly just firebent that warning shot at them, and as she came within 50 yards or so, she launched another, shouting for them to stop where they were.
"Oi! At whom do you think you're shooting?"
Azula demanded indignantly.
I think they think we're with the people who just kidnapped the princess, Ty Lee told her.
Oh, brilliant, Azula replied, rolling her eyes. Then, swinging into the saddle behind her, she asked,
Darling, why does nothing we attempt ever go according to plan?
Don't look at me, said Ty Lee as she put the swoop in motion, zooming off after the train. You're the one with nearly infinite karmic debt.